Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tovin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host, Patrick Kulkin, will return next week. After months of not-so-secret negotiations between lawmakers, business leaders, unions, agricultural workers, and many other factions, the Senate's so-called Gang of Eight released its immigration reform proposal last week. The bill addresses everything from the 11 million immigrants living here without legal residency to high-skilled work visas and border security. Last time broad immigration legislation came up, opponents jammed congressional switchboards with angry protest calls. However, since 2007, momentum has shifted. A recent Washington Post ABC poll found 63% of people supported legalizing unauthorized immigrants, and most of the other proposals enjoyed majority support. This morning, my guest is Peter Ashman, immigration attorney and spokesman for the Las Vegas chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I just wanted to get your initial reactions. I mean, to this proposal, there's been other attempts at comprehensive immigration reform. How good of a job do they do at sort of addressing all the concerns from all sides?
Well, you know, the more I read it, and again, keep in mind that it came in the middle of the night Wednesday morning, and we've had a little over 48 hours to read it. I haven't read the whole bill. It's 844 pages long. But what I've seen of it so far, and the more I look at it, I'm very impressed with the thoroughness and the thoughtfulness of the bill. I mean, it really, when they say comprehensive, this is extremely comprehensive.
Right. And now let's talk about some of the specific provisions. There's, for border security, the bill sets aside $3 billion to improve border security through surveillance drones, 3,500 additional customs agents, and other measures, and then an additional $1.5 billion is set aside for fencing, and then there's a progression in status for immigrants is limited by some security benchmarks. And could you explain a little bit what exactly have they set forth in the proposal in terms of what they want to see from border security in order to get to the to allow the path to citizenship and to the progression for the immigrants?
Well, sure. I want to maybe step back just a little bit and explain. This was the major sticking point in the 06-07 bill. I think there were a lot of people that said, we cannot in this country talk about legalizing 11 or 15 million people until we first secure the border and have, you know, border security and shut that down. I think what opened the door and made it possible for them to do it this time was, I think, frankly, the economy. And when the economy began to slow down, the demand for jobs here in the United States also slowed down, and it cut the need for people, you know, the need for people to come in the country or the need to find jobs. So what the border control parts of this bill really address are I think not even going to be a problem the way the rest of the bill is written, and I'll explain. When you've taken this comprehensive approach, you've allowed for the legal means for people to come in the country legally. When you take away the motive for people to come illegally, you don't really have the kind of problem that we had over the last 10 years. So in the past 10 years, there was no legal way for people to come here. There was a demand for their work and demand for their services, and so they found ways to get here. Now this bill addresses that really for the first time and takes away that sort of motive. So there's no draw anymore for people to come here illegally, because there will be legal channels for them to come. And if there's no jobs because those jobs are filled with illegal means, in other words, there won't be any mm-hmm. magnet.
Right. And well, let's talk about some of these changes in terms of allowing more immigration and what visas they're promoting. It does appear that there's maybe a little bit of a shift taking place with this legislation that puts a greater emphasis on work visas and less emphasis on family ties. Would you agree with
that?
Yeah,
I think it's fair to say. I mean, in the past, our immigration policies have sort of been favoring unification of families, and I still believe that they will. It's just that it's sort of turning a little bit more to businesses and higher skilled, but also lower skilled and agricultural workers. Indeed, it is comprehensive.
Mm-hmm. And so in one of the provisions, right, they'll be phasing out the provision that allows for sponsorship of siblings, right?
Right. Under the current immigration laws, brothers and sisters of U.S. citizens can be petitioned for. So, you know, if I'm a citizen and I have a sister in the Philippines, I'm going to be filing a petition for her. The problem with that is right now it takes almost 20 years for me to be able to bring that sibling over. Mm-hmm. And so that's 20 years where they're waiting in the Philippines and, you know, their kids are growing older, maybe getting married and stuff. So I think the decision was made that those, because there's only a strict number of visas that are available worldwide for all categories, that particular category was sucking numbers out of closer familial relationships like spouses of permanent residents or, you know, minor children of permanent residents, which I think we could all agree that's a more important priority probably than unifying brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, you said there's, you explained to me at one point that there's a change in how they're counting certain visas. So, for example, someone who comes on a work visa now would be able to bring over their family, for example, their wife and children, and that would not count in a certain way that it previously counted. Is that right?
Right. We call those derivative beneficiaries of a petition. So, in other words, if let's say a particular category has 10,000 visas available per year, and we bring somebody over to work for a U.S. employer, and they have like three children and a spouse. Well, we're not talking about one visa number taken out of the quota. We're talking about five. Mm-hmm. So under the new bill, you know, that will be one, and the derivatives will come over, and their numbers won't be applied against the overall cap. I want to get back, though, to the sibling filing thing, because there's a really important catch here, because I know a lot of people were really upset about this initially, and maybe still will be, but there's an 18-month grace period after the bill is enacted where people still will be able to file for sibling citizen petitions, and those petitions would go forward. So it's only after 18 months that drops off. So, you know, if people are planning and they're thinking about it, they can still go ahead and file for their siblings. It's just after 18 years or 18 months, it's going to sunset.
Right. There's still time. And then there is an increase in the number of high-skilled visas available, right? The quotas initially would go up from, 65,000 to 100,000?
Well, right? I believe that's right. I'm focusing a lot more. The details of this bill, because it is just a bill and it's sort of in its infancy, I suspect that the final product could be radically different. Mm-hmm. So I'm more interested in the policy arguments behind it. And what they're doing in the high-tech field and the highly skilled field is this. In the past, for us to be able – let's say, for example, that a young person comes to the United States from, say, India and he gets a master's degree in computer engineering – and becomes, you know, a fantastic software engineer and somebody who is of interest to U.S. employers, I think the decision was they're subject to an overall cap. And that cap for India and China is backlogged several years. So what sense does it make to educate a young person, bring them here, educate them, give them the tools and the skills that they need to then go back to India, compete against our employers? So I think this was one of those fields where finally, they were thoughtful. They carefully thought it through and realized this is bad policy. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to have in the STEM fields, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, we're going to be having people readily and easily be able to get green cards in these areas.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a change, right, in the policy in that for the first time, these businesses will have to show some evidence, right, that they recruited locally. Is that right?
Well, that's for the temporary visas. It's called an H visa. And there's another important change. H visas, for the last several years, have been subject to a cap of, well, by the time you carve out different kinds of exceptions to it, about 55,000 visas per year. Those visas become available on the first day of the fiscal year. So, for example, the 2014 visas, which will allow people to commence working August or October 1st of this year, those visas could begin to be applied for in April 1st of this year. By April 3rd of this year, those visas were all gone. With the app, in fact, they were oversubscribed. So now the immigration is going to have to do a lottery to decide which ones of those applications will even go forward. Now, historically, those employers have had to demonstrate that they're paying at least the prevailing wage, because you know the idea is you don't want to have people hire foreign workers and undercut the wages and working conditions of U.S. workers, but they didn't have to make a demonstration that they tried to recruit U.S. workers first. That's going to change. So starting with this bill, employers in these temporary visas are still going to have to show that they like put newspaper ads and they actively recruited for U.S. workers before they went out and hired a foreign worker. And they're going to have to pay the foreign worker more than they're going to have to pay their domestic workers.
Right. And something that is, I think, of special interest maybe to Las Vegas people is that there will be no more cap right on the people with exceptional talents. I'm not sure what the terminology is,
right.
But the acrobats of the world and things
right.
that really specific talents that not everybody has, right?
Yeah, I love this change because right now that cap is at 10,000. And even though historically that cap has never been met before, those numbers are increasing. And I think they're looking forward to perhaps someday we would have to tell some of the more skilled. And it's not just artists and entertainers, but it's also research scientists and entrepreneurs, internationally famous entrepreneurs. Why would we want to limit anybody who's at the very top of their field worldwide? We would want those people to come here. Historically, those are the people that have made this country really great. You know, we've got the best and the brightest from around the world. So the idea that Congress has looked at this and said, well, we can continue to attract these people, but let's make it easier for them to get in and stay here.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Cirque du Soleil must be excited
about
that.
Well, Cirque has many, many, many of these types of visa holders in their employment.
Right. And now there's, depending on your circumstances as an immigrant, if you're not here with legal status, there's different pathways, right, for dreamers, agricultural workers that have been proposed, and maybe I guess you're just adult immigrants. Could you talk a little bit about some of these distinctions they've made in terms of who would get maybe a shot at citizenship earlier?
Well, the standard path for what we're now calling RPI status is, and that stands for Registered Provisional Immigrant Status. That's the new category. That standard path, we estimate it's going to probably take around 10 years for people to get there. Now, one interesting backstory to this, and I think it's worth talking about to your, I hope your listeners are not bored with this. I find this fascinating, is when the authors of this bill got together and began to, think it through carefully, the idea of waiting 10 years to a lot of people was really, why should we have to wait that long? And it was really unpopular with a lot of the advocacy groups. But part of the reason is when you're drafting a bill, the Congressional Budget Office scores that bill in terms of the impact that that's going to have on the budget of the United States. So in order to make this bill more, have a higher CBO score, in other words, make it not so, imposing on our federal budget, they delayed the citizenship of these people for over 10 years. And the idea is they will not be able to apply for any benefits for that 10-year period. So in terms of costing the American public, this is going to be a net win because the amount of money that they're going to be paying in fines and processing fees and those things is going to be more money than they're going to take back in benefits because they won't be eligible for any benefits. I mean, another common myth is that all these illegal immigrants are here in this country sucking up all the social services and welfare benefits. Right. And that's just false because they're not eligible for them. And
right.
And
a lot of immigrants here legally aren't even eligible for the provisions in the Affordable Care Act.
Correct, right? Correct. So, and that's one myth that I'm glad that you give me the opportunity to kind of clear up. So, back to your question. I mean, there are at least three paths to under this new bill to become a permanent resident, and that's in addition to the ones that preexisted before, which would marriage to a U.S. citizen or a job offer or political asylum. Some of these other ones. The DREAM Act. I think Congress has recognized that of all the categories of people out there, these are young people who, by and large, were brought to this country as children, didn't have any say in the matter, were brought here for the most part without any legal papers, and have grown up in the United States knowing this as really the only home they've ever known. And if you can't be sympathetic for this group of people, I think there's something wrong with you, because they did absolutely nothing wrong here. And many of these kids, if you've ever talked to them like I have, their stories are so inspiring, and they teach me every day why people want to come to this country and why America is a great country. But anyway, their path is somewhat shorter. They will be able to apply for RPI status initially, and they'll have that status for 5 years. And at the end of the five-year period, if they've still maintained their status, if they've not been, convicted of any crimes, or they've paid their taxes and done all the things that they're supposed to do, after 5 years, they can apply for permanent resident status. And immediately upon receiving permanent resident status, they will be allowed to apply for citizenship. Now, some of your listeners out there may not understand that there's a big difference between being a permanent resident of the United States and being a citizen. Only citizens can vote. Only citizens can hold passports. Only citizens are eligible for certain jobs in federal government. But a permanent resident basically can stay here, travel outside the country, you know, live here with sort of, you know, but they still could be deported if they commit any serious crimes. So the set that, so in addition to the 10-year path for the traditional RPI people, the Dream Act get 5, and then there's a 5-year path for certain farm workers, agricultural workers. So we won't see many of those in Las Vegas.
Right. But for places like California, sure, and the South, that's a big issue. Obviously, a lot of agricultural workers there.
Well, and I think if we can step back, one of the reasons why I think this bill is happening, because we in the Southwest, we have seen the tremendous growth of the Latino community over the last, you know, I've lived in Las Vegas since the 60s, and, you know, there's whole areas of town now that are Latino areas, the majority areas. But now it's not just the Southwest. It's Arkansas, it's North Carolina, it's Iowa, where the meatpacking is, where the chicken processing is. Wherever there's a lot of low-skilled work, you can rest assured that you're going to see large Latino and growing Latino communities.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I wanted to get into with the registered provisional immigrant, sort of the standard path as they're calling it, is there is a provision, you know, that you would you would be in this status for, I believe, 10 years as you work your way towards the ability to get into the citizenship path. And there are some provisions that mention that you can't be unemployed for a certain period of time, I think 60 consecutive days.
Right.
Now, that could change. But I understand, obviously, you want to have provisions making sure that they're not becoming like public wards and people are employed and contributing. But, I mean, being unemployed for 2 months, I mean, over a 10-year period, do you feel that, will they really stick to that? Is that going to be a hard and fast rule? Will that be a sticking point for a lot of people?
Well, I know that one of the big concerns of, you know, some of the opponents of the early registration back in the 06 and 07 was, you know, we don't want to create a situation where people come here and then are able to take advantage of I don't think they're so generous from my perspective, but our social services in this country. I think they put that thing in there about you wouldn't qualify for permanent residence if during your period of RPI status you've been unemployed for more than 60 continuous days. My understanding from a follow-up call with Senator Menendez, a conference call Wednesday night, he indicated, and he was one of the Gang of Eight, one of the drafters of the bill, he had indicated that that provision will have implicit in there an understanding that if you're unemployed for reasons other than your own volition, like let's say, for example, maybe you were hurt on the job and you can't work, or maybe your company went bankrupt and, you know, your job was eliminated, that there will be provisions and exceptions for that. I think what they're looking for are people who are intentionally unemployed for more than 60 days at a time.
I see. And now moving on, one thing that in the Washington Post ABC poll, I think was one of the most popular provisions that was polled about was the idea that all employers would be required to use E-Verify to check the immigration status of job applicants. And that had 83% of the public supporting that provision. And I was just wondering if, you know, are there any issues with that system as it currently works now? Are there ever false positives or false negatives? Any issues with implementing that system, you know, countrywide mandating it?
Yeah, there have been historically a lot of problems with the database that's a Social Security database on whether or not these people are legally able to work. And there was one anecdotal story that occurred for a staffer who worked for one of the congresswomen from California who was on the immigration subcommittee. Her staffer, they ran her clearance through, and it came back a false negative. This person, it also became kind of a story on national news. Now this person is just named to be an immigration judge in Los Angeles, so it's a little funny. But there have been instances in the past of false positives. That's probably the biggest concern personally that I have, and that is if they get this right and they get the data right, mm-hmm. then I don't think there's a problem with this. Mm-hmm. I know there's going to be a lot of people out there that will not like the idea of a national ID card. And my understanding is it will only be for non-citizens. But that non-citizens, in other words, if you can prove you're a citizen, you don't need to carry, you don't need to be involved with Real ID. But if you're a non-citizen, you're going to need to have. Now, maybe eventually it will lead to that. I don't know. I kind of think that you can't expect the group of people that have concerns about this to give up their opposition of a bill unless they have something that makes them comfortable, and that's the spirit of compromise. And so civil libertarians are going to be opposed to this. I think people on the far left and the far right might be against this idea of an ID card. But I think it's just one of those necessary things that we're going to have, because how else are we going to track whether or not people are eligible to work? Now, one of the failings of IRCA, the Reagan amnesty bill, one of the failings of that bill was that it really didn't have any teeth in it in terms of how do you – I mean, that bill was designed to give amnesty, but then at the same time, it was designed to punish employers who hire undocumented workers. Well, number one, how does an employer tell if someone's undocumented or not? You could go to a swap meet and buy a pretty good-looking Social Security card, and a lot of employers would just, you know, look the other way too. So Real ID and – I mean, sorry, the E-Verify – should resolve that. And again, if the database is accurate, then I think that's probably going to end up being a good thing. Now, it's not right away. It's phased in over 5 years. The larger employers will start first. But after 5 years, all U.S. employers will need to participate in E-Verify.
And I'm glad you brought up the Reagan amnesty, because amnesty is a word that's thrown out right. A lot. And that's something that I'd say opponents bring up, that don't allow amnesty. This is amnesty. But looking at this bill as a whole and this path to legal residency, to citizenship, should we call it amnesty? I mean, is it really an amnesty, which is just letting someone off sort of?
Well, yeah, I tend to think of amnesty being, you know, recognizing that somebody has done something wrong and then exercising some act of forgiveness of doing that wrong and then, you know, letting them just go. I mean, we see it when sometimes, you know, you have overdue library books and they say, okay, everybody, we're going to have an amnesty on the library fines or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is clearly not that. I mean, again, I think someone's going to have to show a great deal of interest and a great deal of personal sacrifice and attention to this path that they're going to be taking. I don't know if it's – I'd probably call it a minefield to citizenship, because there's all kinds of problems along the way that could happen. Like, they're going to have to pay all their back taxes. They're going to have to stay totally crime-free, really, for that 10-year period. I mean, even they say that to qualify for RPI status, you can't have three misdemeanors or a felony or a gross – or what we call an aggravated felony, which is a more serious felony. Okay, that's fine. But what it doesn't say is what's going to happen during that 10-year period too. What if someone gets a DUI? You know, would they be excluded? I kind of think that under what I'm reading, they would be. Hmm. So, yeah, we want these people to earn the right to become U.S. citizens, and I think that's what the bill does. They have to pay a significant amount of money. They have to wait a long time. They have to go to the back of a very long line. There are people who have been waiting in line legally for many, many years, and these RPI will not be able to process until all of those people who are already waiting have been processed. So it really does give the opponents of the 06 and 07 bills, it addresses their concerns and deals with those in a way that I think, again, everybody, you know, everybody that I've talked to of the interest groups out there are somewhat happy and somewhat unhappy about the bill. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really telling, because if you saw if business and the Chamber of Commerce was just thrilled to death over all this, then we would know the bill is more a pro-business bill. They're not happy about it because there's a lot more hurdles that an employer has to jump through to hire foreign workers. The advocacy group, the Latino, the Asian American groups, they're not happy because it eliminates those categories that we discussed, mm-hmm. And that there's a substantial waiting period. So I think they met in the middle on a lot of these issues. They put a lot of thought, a lot of work into it. I'm very optimistic that it's going to go
right. And now moving to sort of a current events issue that. It's kind of unfortunate, I would say, for in terms of level-headed discourse, that the bill came out the same week as the bombings at the Boston Marathon. And now later in the week, obviously, we've found out that the two suspects are immigrants, it appears, maybe from Chechnya. It's all a little fuzzy right now as we're in the studio. And I was just wondering if you see this. Some senators, even before we knew anything about the suspects, were already saying that now is not the time to move forward with immigration reform, that this is a reason we, you know, to not legalize immigrants here. What's your take on in terms of what this bill would do, and if it's in terms of safety and security in the United States?
Well, yeah, I mean, one thing, it's a little early to say what, if anything, changing this bill would have changed. Had this bill been in effect 10 years ago, would it have eliminated this? Would it have kept these people out? By early indications, it does appear that they came in a legitimate way and they had green cards. I think the bigger issue is right now there are about 11 million people in this country, maybe more, maybe a lot more, that don't have any papers, that we don't even know who they are. They haven't been fingerprinted. This bill will require that all of those people, if they want to have any kind of legal status in this country, that they have to come forward, step out of the shadows, get fingerprinted, register, have their photographs taken, all of these things. If people aren't going to do that, and then after all this is done and the RPI, you know, the status is given to the 11 million, if there are still people out there that haven't done this, I think it's looking for a needle in a much smaller haystack. So would that have helped eliminate this kind of thing? I don't know. I mean, I think how do you eliminate those people out there in the world that want to do us harm? Yeah. And I think, you know, the lessons from 9/11, the people that attacked us in 9/11, they were all here on legal visas, in student visas. We don't want to eliminate student visa categories. We want to up the security. We want to be able to know who we are, but we're never going to be able to entirely protect ourselves, not with surrendering every single civil liberty that we have in this country.
Right. And also, moving on, obviously, you're from you're an attorney, and you've also mentioned that this is a bill, and it'll probably change, and nothing is set in stone yet, nothing has passed, and so people should not be, say, going and applying for any register. If people tell you can apply for registered status, that is not true, right? And
right.
Everybody should hold tight, right, and wait and see what happens.
I'm really glad you made that point. You know, about a year ago, the president announced this DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and the precursor to the DREAM Act. And immediately we saw in radio and in print ads, we saw people, especially in the Latin community, saying, oh, you know, come see us. We'll help you process the papers for the new Obama amnesty and, you know, all these kinds of things. There will always be people trying to take advantage of other people, whether they're, you know, what they call notarios, which are in Latin America are considered substantially more than a notary public, you know, which is what they are here. But I think there's some confusion in that community over what abilities these people have to help them. So I think the advice is don't do anything now. Try to get yourself educated. There will be meetings. There are so many grassroots organizations out there, Hermandad Mexicana, Mi Familia Vota, American Immigration Lawyers Association, our organization. There will be so many groups holding forums and seminars and, you know, to educate people on what the bill does. As the bill moves towards law, which we're expecting, it's probably not going to happen at least until August from what we're hearing, we'll have plenty of time to go into the community and educate the community about this. Keep your money in your wallets. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your money on people who are saying now, oh, come in now and we'll put you at the head of the line. We'll open up a file for you now and, you know, pay us X amount of money. Be very, very careful. If people are asking you for money on a bill that hasn't even become law yet.
All right. Well, you know, it's certainly interesting legislation in that it covers a lot of bases, and it'll be interesting to see how this goes forward. But that's all the time we have today. You've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. Our guest today was Peter Ashman, an immigration attorney in Las Vegas and spokesman for the American Immigration Lawyers Association local chapter. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And our producer is Steven Zeller. We'll see you next week.